How do you create advertising that becomes part of conversations and stands out? Dean Olshick, founder and MD of Halo, a design-led creative agency, shares some of their insight from recent work.
You can either create something memorable that people remember and will have an emotional attachment to that for the next 6 to 12 months, or whatever, or longer, hopefully, or you just advertise to them all the time.
Some advertising is seen as a distraction in consumers' lives, while other work trends and becomes part of our vocabulary.
When we took this brief, we were given 3-month KPIs on what we wanted this, what they hoped that this campaign could achieve. And we'd reached those 3-month KPIs in the second week of the campaign running.
In this episode, we talk about why that is.
I mean, the short answer is emotion.
And discuss some of the human insight that can be drawn from some of the most successful examples.
Please stop thinking the consumers are dumb. They're not. The consumers are really, really smart, and they appreciate when you give them the time of day.
This is The Lead Creative. Welcome to the Lead Creative Podcast, where we talk to creative industry leaders, influencers, and brands. We discuss the strategies that influence brand thinking and shape industries. Thought leaders and heads of agencies let us in on some of their thinking and insights. I'm your host, Mongezi Simthati. Enjoy the show, and please share and subscribe. Dean, thank you very much for joining us on The Lead Creative. It's such a privilege to have you on the show.
Hi, Mongezi. Thanks for having me.
All good. All good. Just before we kick off, just a simple sort of question. I think the question of inspiration comes up a lot within the creative space. Where or how would you say you draw your inspiration for the creative work that you come up with?
Sure. You've started the conversation on a real tough one. I think inspiration comes from everything around you. I recently became a father in the last 3 years and dealing with two kids now, I find that I'm so much more attuned to the insights of parenthood. And I think, you know, I'd be much better copywriter now for anything around parent brands than I would have been 10 years ago. And that inspiration comes from moments I see and think of funny or entertaining or interesting. I get a lot of inspiration when I'm running. I think it's the only way I can really quieten my mind and let thoughts come to me. And I think most people find their own way of thinking about things. But that's the one that seems to work for me the best. But yeah, like inspiration for me is an ongoing pursuit of just searching and looking and observing the world and listening and picking out insights that you think are curious or things that, you know, other people might recognize. And yeah, I've learned that lesson with my kids.
Yeah. No, that's a great one. That's a great point. Over the past 2 or so weeks, there's a piece of work that's been trending on social media for its creativity, for its humor, for how it uses out of home advertising to be memorable. Can you talk us through what that piece of work is and the thinking behind that work?
Yeah, thanks. I mean, it's always weird when you put a piece of work out into the world because you live in hope that it's going to be received really, really, really well. And I've always been of the opinion that rather put something out in the world that you believe is going to have an equal chance of getting as much love as it's going to get some hate, because then at least it's drawing some kind of an emotional response from people. And if it doesn't do that, then I think you're wasting your time. And it always gets really disappointing for me when I put something out there and everyone's like, oh, that's nice. And this was not that. And so this is, you're referencing the pineapple insurance work and, you know, we worked on it for so long and we had so many different iterations of the campaign and the thinking behind it. And I think we took the brief in December last year and we went back. The idea initially was a television idea, was a film idea, and the clients decided that outdoor is the best path for them to launch their brand. They just believe in outdoor as a medium. And so we had to kind of adapt. We had to adapt a TV idea for outdoor. And we just got, we had come up with a strategic idea of the fairest insurance in the land. And they're like that because, you know, if you meet the founders of Pineapple Insurance, they've got incredible intentions and just such good intentions. They started this. So many businesses start out of frustration with something, or frustration with an industry, or frustration with the way of things that get done. And these guys have started this business out of a frustration of, I guess, insurance being super competitive, but also a race to the bottom at the same time, and almost an incentivization for insurance companies to not pay claims. And the more claims they don't pay, the more profit they make. And so they set out this business, and they created a business that essentially the operational costs of the business is a percentage of the premiums that you pay, and the balance of the premiums goes into a pot to look after a community of people. And if the community needs to pay claims, then they pay the claims. And if there's money left over at the end, it goes back to your pockets. And that's, if you go back in the history of insurance, that's how insurance always was invented. Back in the, it was originally invented in the shipping industries in the early 1800s, if memory serves me correct. And that's how they did it. It was a community of people who put money in, and if something went wrong, they could pay out and get back on their feet. And that intention exists within the way Pineapple exists as a business and a brand. And so we love this idea of fairness. You know, I think it's a really good place for a business like insurance to start from. And they do. We tested this at length with them, and we would never come up with a strategy that doesn't have some tie back to a real deliverable within the business. And fairness was the big thing. So out of fairness came, we wanted to create a campaign that came across as trying to show insurance as being fair. And we came up with this idea of 100% pure insurance, 0% anything else. And originally we creatively played in spaces of organic insurance and, you know, vegan insurance, if there was such a thing, and we started, like, those are some fair creative territories. And it was just these really creative, territories that were quite fertile around what you could do with 100% pure insurance. And we ended up in a space of honesty. And we created I think one of the first lines we created is actually still on a billboard now, has gone up on a billboard, and it says, and we went into the boardroom with the clients, and we presented this billboard, and it said, in inverted commas, as a quotation, the founder of Pineapple's a guy named Manus, and we put a billboard up that said, "Well, that's never going to sell insurance," quote by Manus, and we preempted the whole campaign with this idea that the initial reaction to this thing is going to be, "Well, that's never going to sell insurance," and almost every person you speak to has had a negative experience that needed a little bit of honesty in its own self, its insurance, and that was kind of the creative idea. And so we wanted to be self-aware. We wanted to be authentic. We wanted to be, and we used the word, and this has almost become a checkbox that the client has bought into, which has been amazing, is it had to be slightly self-deprecating. It had to relook at themselves in a way that was quite humorous. And there was a famous campaign, I'm sure you know, in when KFC couldn't deliver chicken. They had a shortage of chicken in the UK, and their agency at the time just flipped the letters around, and it just said FCK. So it was just like, I think people just so appreciate brands being honest and taking a look at themselves.
And I think this is one of those things that stands out in the social media posts that I'm seeing, where people comment on this piece of work. It's, yes, it's the humor on the one side, but on the other side of it, it's the honesty and how people find it to almost to resonate with them as a piece of work that just makes sense. How do you get to a point, though, where you convince a client that in this instance, simplicity is the way to go? being a little bit self-deprecating is the way to go. How do you get to that point? How do you earn that trust with a new client?
So, I mean, I think 99.9% of clients would not have approved this work. And I have to say that. And I think we have in the past done work that's done similar types of things, and maybe not to this degree. Maybe the client hasn't had the eggs to go for it. But I must say up front, like this client is not that. Like this client wanted that work. They demanded it almost. And so it was very easy for us to convince him to go for this. In fact, I don't even think it was ever a debate. We originally presented, I think, 3 or 4 different ideas in terms of how to do the first campaign. As I mentioned, this was originally a TV idea, and they immediately gravitated towards this one, and they said, this is the one we have to go with, but we have to do it on Outdoor. We then went and started fine tuning the campaign to be an Outdoor campaign. They bought it. They bought it immediately. They loved it. They laughed, and they felt it. I think the client felt that they laughed. Their customers will laugh. And the difference between a startup or a challenger brand like Pineapple and a bigger insurance brand, let's not use any names, is that the decision maker is who the decision maker is. And in this case, the decision makers were all the founders of the business. So there was no one above them that had to buy into this. There was no one above them that was going to judge their decision-making process and how could they have done this? How could they put a billboard up that said what it says? And whereas at a big insurance brand, you know, it's a marketing director who's got a group marketing director above them, who's got a CEO above them, and then has got a board above them. And everyone, often clients, I think, they judge creative work from a place of a little bit of fear. I'm not saying they're all fearful of it, but there's a little bit of fear ingrained in it. And people always, if 10 people were speaking about you, one was saying a negative thing and 9 was saying positive things, you'd worry about the one negative. You'd worry about why is that person saying negative things about me? Why is that person saying bad things about me? It's just the way we're inclined as human beings to be worrying about the negative stuff. And, you know, we're built with good fear receptors. And so people often judge work like that. People judge work going, well, what is it 1 out of 10 person going to say? Whereas the Pineapple guys were like, I can't wait for the hate. They were like, I can't wait for people to not like this, because then they've clearly missed it. They're clearly not the audience. They're clearly not the target market. They clearly don't get it. And if we get it, if we find it funny, then the people we're supposed to be talking to find it funny. And because they're young and because they're startups and because that they're in any startup, it's probably a little bit more aggressive in their approach. They realize that there's a whole audience out there of young under 35s who no one's speaking to or no one's speaking with because no one speaks their language. Like those guys don't resonate with an Outsurance or a My Way or a like one of these established or Sunlum. These guys aren't connecting with those brands because those brands aren't speaking to them at all. We just spoke to people and we just spoke to the TikTok generation in the way that they want to be spoken to or speak about or the way they speak about insurance. Yeah, yeah. But we just did it on a billboard. You know, if this campaign was a digital campaign, I don't think it would have succeeded. But it was almost this audacity to put those words up on a billboard that people were like, whoa. And then ironically, it went viral on social media.
So that's where I think that's where I want to jump in. I think, in terms of just the social, I think the digital sort of campaign, following the success of, you know, the out of home and the billboards, did this have any influence on the digital campaign or the digital or their approach to digital? Because another piece of work that I noticed that you guys have worked on as well is work for Naked Insurance, where it feels and looks as though both the outdoor and the ads that I see, at least on YouTube and everywhere else, speak the same language. In this instance, did the two pieces of work almost influence digital, or was the golden thread established, and then the two teams went their separate ways?
Yeah. So, so Naked was a brand we worked on about 2 years ago, when we created the Get Naked on Your Land Rover, Get Naked on Your Car, Get Naked on Your Mountain Bike campaign, which they've run with for 2 years, and I think it's established a good narrative for their brand. And there's definitely commonality between these two brands. Like, they are the two disruptor insurance brands in the market. And I think that there's obviously something about our agency that is that attracted them to us. And because they're the two disruptors, they're the two that are prepared to be a bit more disruptive in the way that they advertise and communicate. The digital stuff was definitely an extension of the campaign. We wrote one of my favorite lines that we've written in the campaign. It's nothing that most people would have seen because we haven't shared any of the digital work, but it's highly integrated. But it says, there's an ad that says, if you're seeing this ad, our targeting works. And then there's another ad that says, if you see this ad, our retargeting works. And we've kind of targeted to someone to see it one after the other. And it's just that,
yeah,
it's just that honest assessment again of how digital ads do it and how digital ads, like,
yes,
you know, did you mention insurance? Because here we are in your feed, you know, like it's that honest assessment of how advertising works and almost making light of the fear that people have of brands and how they get almost too close to you. So the strategy was, I think the strategy is really set up front and then it was just extended into the different media. We wanted to lead with outdoor because if you just look at the conversion funnel, you know, the outdoor has a very set purpose, and that's to drive awareness and some brand love. Like, that's it. Like, there's nothing else to it. And once it gets to some consideration phases, then that's when the digital stuff needs to kick in. So it does happen down the funnel, and it obviously makes sense for it to be aligned with the campaign creatively. And there's other things that we're looking at the moment, just to try to extend the campaign into different media, just to try and keep it really, really fun and fresh, because that, I think, is going to be the biggest challenge moving forward.
Right. With more and more conversations pointing towards, you know, out of home being less impactful or billboards being less impactful, how can brands still make the most of it?
Well, it's not true, right? I don't know, you know, the people who are saying these things are people who've got massive incentives to benefit from that belief in play. And, you know, Cannes 10 years ago or 20 years ago was run by, the whole Cannes Advertising Awards was run by the big networks and the big agencies. It's now run by Google and Facebook. And they've got the biggest, because they've got the biggest finger in the pie. And so it's up to them to direct the conversation towards digital, and people have started to fall for that. And there's also an element of measurability on digital that you can't achieve necessarily on outdoor. And that's also, again, if people are fearful of their jobs, if people are fearful of their positions, if people want to justify the work that they're doing, and if they've got really, you know, low expectations around what advertising could achieve for the brand, then by all means go digital, because you're going to be able to measure those results and you're going to be able to justify your position and your decision making. Whereas above the line, it's still winning. Like the returns that we received, the returns that Pineapple have got out of this campaign, so let me paint the picture. This is a digital business that started in 2017. They're 5 years old. They've only ever been on digital in 5 years, trying to build the brand on digital media. And for the first time ever, they went on outdoor on the 1st of September. And when we took this brief, we were given 3-month KPIs on what we wanted what they hoped that this campaign could achieve. And we'd reached those 3-month KPIs in the second week of the campaign running. And that's, you just don't get that return on digital. And I know why. Like, it's the psychology of social proof, right? If you see something on your phone, you're the only, in your world, you're the only person seeing something on your phone. Whereas if you see something on an outdoor and there's 50 other people around you, you already know that those 50 other people are seeing that. And so it feels bigger. It just feels bigger. Psychologically, it feels bigger. And therefore, you feel the brand is bigger. You feel that they've got more credibility. They've got more trust. The audacity to say certain things on those media would be significantly, would have a bigger impact than saying it on social media. And so outdoor is definitely working. Just another anecdotal answer, another anecdotal piece of evidence around this is Yoko, right? Now, I think Yoko is one of the darling brands in South Africa. And we were unbelievably privileged to work on Yoko a couple of times over the past 3 years. And they did a rebrand. They did a rebrand last year to try pull their brand more into an African context. It felt like quite banky and quite European, and they wanted to make it way more African and way more context. And they've got an amazing head of design at Yoko in Yoko Studio called Elton, and he led the whole brand evolution. And so we did the campaign last year for them on this. And the campaign launched in I think August last year, and it was the first time, so Yoko, I think, Greg, I could be wrong. It started about 2014. So it's about seven. The brand was about 7 years old. Again, only been on digital. They obviously had physical presence in stores and the retail environments that they operated in. But last year, August, was the first time Yoko went onto television and did some supported that with out of home. They went since then. I must be careful of what I can and can't say. But the campaign itself ran from August last year to February this year. So 6 months. And in 6 months, that of a 7-year-old business, they increased their business size by 65%. They went from roughly 120,000 customers to over 200,000 customers in 6 months. And it was the first time they ever went on above the line. Now, I mean, I'm selling my campaign short because hopefully it had something to do with that, but also I have to be realistic around where they were. And I think a combination of great creative and great media placement always does the job better than anything else.
Right.
But, but above the line media is just, you can't compete with it at the moment. It's too powerful. It's too big. You know, even the comments, I think considering everything, the work on social media has got about 500,000 impressions. Like, and we think that's a big number, but that's one billboard gets, you know, like that's not going to change the game. Like not like it does in the real world. And I think in a South African context, above the line media and outdoor and radio and television it still has huge returns. And I think
that's what I wanted to ask. That's what I wanted to get to. Is it perhaps where we find ourselves as a country and as a continent in that we are more trusting or somewhat more trusting of some mediums over others? And besides that, is it not perhaps a combination of various mediums hitting the same person that it increases trust and it increases that brand love that you were referring to?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm not a media planner, I'm a media strategist, and we had very little play. We had very little play in the decision to go. I mean, we presented outdoor work and we wanted them to go in outdoor. We pushed them for that, but we had very little play in the planning of the actual outdoor. And I think that's been a huge success of theirs in the way that they've got a campaign that's seemingly everywhere. Much like the drip campaign, right? Like it's just everywhere you go.
Yes.
You see drip billboards. And, there's too many small brands on social. There's too many, you know, t-shirt startups or beauty brands or like little startups that exist on social media that you keep coming across. And I think then when you see a brand that's a startup that you don't know, like a pineapple that you've never heard of before, you put them in the same boat as that. You put them in like, oh, they're a startup or they're like a young up and coming. And like, and that doesn't necessarily come with a whole bunch of trust and credibility. Whereas you see them on a billboard, and then you see them all over on a billboard, and you're suddenly like, okay, hang on, these guys are obviously the real deal, right? And that immediately reduces any risk associated with a purchase of that nature that you might take with an insurance brand, especially a startup insurance brand. And I think insurance is just one of those industries that is very, very tough to sell. I think that I think the buyer's behavior is very long term. I think that we inevitably stay with that. Once we get an insurance brand, once we buy an insurance brand, we generally stay with them for probably 18 months to maybe 5 years, you know, and we possibly only enter the buyer's cycle we probably only enter that buyer cycle once we buy a new car. Or, you know, some people might at the beginning of the year reassess their finances and go, maybe I should shop around and see if I can find a better deal. You can either create something memorable that people remember and will have an emotional attachment to that for the next 6 to 12 months or whatever, or longer, hopefully, or you just advertise to them all the time. And big brands can afford to just advertise to people all the time, and they can be everywhere to everyone. And yeah, like probably, I would assume Arturans is probably in that boat, and they're probably the biggest. And then you've got the guys who don't have that kind of budget, and they've got to do the other thing. They've got to create something that stands out and gets people talking and gets people loving it, and then go, wow, that's amazing. And then 6 months from now, when they're thinking about when they get a new car and they want to change insurance, then Pineapple's the one that they consider because it's the one that they remember.
If you're enjoying The Lead Creative, please share this episode with your network and hit follow or subscribe. Enjoy the show.
So in your experience, how do you then stand out like that as a brand? Stand out and be that brand that sticks in people's, you know, memories so that when they are shopping in 6-8 months time, you are the one they think about, even though you didn't advertise to them often as the competitor.
I mean, the short answer is emotion, and this is where, like, awareness for me is just a fallacy. I'm aware of Absa. I don't bank with them. I'm aware of FNB. I don't bank with them anymore. I'm aware of Standard Bank. I'm aware of Capitec. I'm aware of all these brands. I don't need to be more aware of them. What I need is a feeling towards them. I need an emotion. And you know, there's an amazing science that's come out recently around emotion. Apparently, there's about 127 emotions in the world that we could be, as human beings, we can feel. Three are negative, and they're based out of six core sets, and out of those six, three of them are positive, and three of them are negative. And as a brand, you need to be tapping into emotion. And if you're not doing that, you're just wasting money. And you could do it in many ways. You can make people laugh, like Nando's or Chicken Licken. You can make people cry, like there was a famous campaign done by Dial Direct many years ago, or Bell's. Bell's did it with the reader, the guy whose dad learns how to read so he can read his son's book. You know, part of the Give the Man a Bell's campaign. Rags to riches stories are often like emotional tearjerker stories. Like, there's many ways of creating emotion. So I feel like people have got the whole idea of brand purpose the wrong way around. People think brand purpose is the only way to resonate with an audience, whereas brand purpose is one way, right? There's other ways. Like Nando's doesn't have brand purpose. Like they're political and they sell chicken, and it works for them, right? Because they've realized how to tap into people's emotions. They just do it in a very different way. Patagonia, on the other hand, which is obviously on top of everyone's minds at the moment, because of what they've done recently, taps into emotion a different way. Like it taps into people's passion around the environment and global warming and climate change. And they've built purpose into their business, and their purpose is kind of something that they communicate through their marketing. So it's got to be about marketing. I wish I could share an image, and maybe I'll send it to you, and you can put it into the link of the podcast. But there's a psychological model called the hierarchy of effects, and the hierarchy of effects is basically the decision making process that us as human beings go through every time we make a decision, and And I'm gonna go through it, and I'll use a few examples and how it works. And I think like this is the basis. This should be the basis of almost all communication, or strategy, and all creative. So the hierarchy of effects basically divides the brain's decision making process into three stages. The first stage is cognitive. The second stage is what's called effective, and the third stage is cognitive. Now, cognitive is the desire. Cognitive stage of our brain is the desire of understanding. So if we saw something that was stood out, that was really strange or really odd or really weird, like we saw a pink elephant flying in the sky, we'd have a need to understand that. We'd be like, what the hell is that? Or often when you see a new brand or a new business coming out, you have a need to understand it. You're like, what is that? And that's the awareness stage. That's the stage where I go, what is that? Oh, okay, cool. I get it. Someone explains it to me, and I'm like, okay, cool, I've got it. And you move on with your life. Now that's the cognitive stage. And that's where awareness ticks that box. I know what it is, and I have an understanding of what it does. That's only one third of the psychological decision-making process. The second stage is what's called effective. Now that's, we use that word quite a lot through affection. Do I have some affection towards it? Now, if I don't have affection towards something, I'm never going to have a decision. Nothing is going to drive my behavior to buy that. Now, affection can come in many different ways, because affection is really emotion, right? It's, do I have a preference for it, or do I have a liking to it? Now, we can have preference to things that are cheaper than something else. So like if we are buying insurance, and some people buy insurance only by what's cheapest. And they'll go through 15 quotes until they find what's cheapest. And then their preference is the thing that's cheapest. Whereas most people are actually prepared to pay, and proof this, you know, there's so much science behind this. We're prepared to pay for a little bit more for something better, or we're prepared to pay a little bit more for something that we prefer. And that's the effective stage. And brands need to make sure that they can satisfy that effective stage. They can become effective. Now, and then it leads us to the third stage. And the third stage is the conviction, is the cognitive stage, which is really the convictional purchase stage. Now that is when you've shown someone something, they're aware of it, you've made them love you, and now you've got to make it easy to buy. You know, Superbalist does this amazingly well. Like we all have affection towards a specific pair of sneakers. That affection is built into us because we just like what they look like, or we've seen them on a friend. Mm. There's no work. Yeah. Superbalist doesn't have to do the job to make us like a pair of Nike sneakers. That work's already been done, you know, through 50 years of Nike communication and advertising. But they have to make it easy for us to buy it. And they do that. They put an ad on Instagram, and you're scrolling through, and there's a pair of sneakers. And before you even thought about it, you bought the pair of sneakers, right? And you had no intention of buying a pair of sneakers that day. They made it easy to buy. But the other two, the awareness and the affection stage, were already taken care of. Now, an insurance brand, you've got a lot of work to do to get both all three of those boxes ticked. And I think like any brand that doesn't understand that, any brand that just goes out there and just thinks, if I spend more money on media, I'm going to get people coming through the door, and it'll work to a certain degree, but you're never going to get the return on that investment. Like you're never going to get – that thing's never going to give you a 2x or a 3x or a 4x return. And we try to teach our clients that. We try to teach people that you've got to speak to what people are interested in. You've got to speak to what people are, what they love, what they hate, what they're scared of, what they fear, what they whatever. And that is called insight, right? And that hasn't changed. You know, trying to find a good insight hasn't changed in advertising in 50 years. That's like Ogilvy spoke about that. You know, that has not changed. And like,
in your view, Dean, what makes certain pieces of work stand out and become part of conversation, and others become, you know, a distraction to people? I know you've mentioned insights. I know you've mentioned insight as part of that, and I know you've mentioned, you know, you've mentioned this affection that we have for one brand or one piece of one message over another. You know, it's also no secret that over time, we all we skip ads and we skip anything that looks like an ad, whether on TV, on digital, on the road, next to the highway. We are, it's become ingrained in us to skip ads. But you've just mentioned Drip, for instance, and we are talking about Pineapple Insurance, and there's many others. You've mentioned Nando's, you've mentioned Chicken Licken. What makes one piece of work welcomed and part of the conversation and another a distraction?
If I knew the answer to that, I would be a rich man, and I'm not a rich man. I think you can start the conversation.
But a rich man would say that, though.
Yeah, maybe, but I'm not a rich man. let's take advertising off the table for a second. Let's just talk about let's just talk about creativity for a second. Mm-hmm. Because you've got to answer that question, or to understand the answer to that question, you've got to look at what makes one movie a box office success and another movie not. What makes a track that Beyonce releases that flops versus a track that Beyonce releases that is a hit? Like, what happens there? What makes it succeed? I don't think that there's a science to that. I think that that's the beauty of creativity, right? It's an intuition. The greatest creators in the world are people who intuitively understand that this thing that I'm putting out is going to resonate with people, and they're going to be connected to it, and they're going to love it, and they're going to buy it, and they're going to share it, whatever it is. And, you know, and some things happen quickly, you know, they're super novel, and a song comes out and it's number one in 2 weeks, and then 2 months later it's dead and you've never heard it, you'll never hear of it again. Like Mambo Number 5, you know, as an old classic, and like, it was just, everywhere you looked, it was heard, and then it didn't happen. And then you get other type of creativity that's more an acquired taste, and it takes people a lot longer to learn to love. And once they do love they will, you know, they'll love it for the rest of their lives, and they have a deep connection to it. And that connection might be driven by a time in their life that the music came out, or whatever the reason is. And yeah, it's a very hard topic of conversation to kind of understand. I think that, you know, you can even find advertisers. I mean, you can even find famous actors who've been in movies, and like, the movie's been a huge success, and then you've had the same actor being in a different movie, and the movie's a total failure. Or like, you can take the critic approach to it and you go, like, what's the best movie Leonardo DiCaprio's ever acted in? Well, according to the Oscars, I've just gone blank on what the movie's called. The Snow one, the one with the bear, that was the best movie he ever acted in. But, you know, is that the best movie he's ever acted in? Well, I don't think so. I think he's acted in way more entertaining movies over the years. And then, well, is best equal, does best equal favorite? No, because the best movie he acted in probably didn't get nearly close to the same revenue that some of the other movies he acted in. And so then you're like starting to dissect who the audience is, and what do the audience resonate with, and whatnot. And then you can look at like some of the teenage musicians, or, you know, when I was growing up, there were the boy bands and the Spice Girls, and like, none of the stuff makes sense, bro. Like, it's there's no scientific way of looking at this and going, oh, well, Spice Girls had this, and this, and therefore that's what made them succeed. Okay, now you've got to add the complexity of you're doing this on behalf of a brand, and you're actually this isn't about entertaining anymore. This isn't about giving something to the world and hoping that they take it. This is about forcing it down people's throats. And I think that's what advertising does badly, is that it often forces down people's throats. People think there's a great quote, which I'll call up now and I'll read it to you, because I think it summarizes really well the mistakes that marketers and advertisers make. But people think that that advertising is just about getting in front of enough people and you'll do it. You'll do a good enough job. It doesn't work like that. You have to get people on your side, and you can only get people on your side if you are actually able to resonate with them. And now you're asking them to, on behalf of a brand that's clearly paid for this thing.
Yeah.
to engage with this communication. And the quote goes like this. It says, a lot of advertising is geared towards persuasion rather than building mental availability. Persuasion is about assuming you're in the room and you're arguing your point. Okay, that's what most billboards do. They think that they're already in the room and now they just got to argue their point. Whereas mental availability is about getting into the room. And so that's the big challenge. Most organizations are failing to get into the room, but they're spending all their money on arguing as if they're already there. And I think that, like, it's such a great way of looking at advertising. It's like there's just too many brands out there. There's too many messages. There's too many media. Like, Twitter. Yeah. Like yesterday, I was on Twitter, and like every fourth post now is an ad. And I'm like, have they just done that? Have they just like overnight just turned on advertising on Twitter? And like, I think people will leave Twitter so fast if that's the case, because these are like, now you're relying on algorithm to assume that I'm an audience for this brand, and like they get it wrong 10 times in a row. I've got 25% of my Twitter feed is totally irrelevant to me. Whereas, now going back to my examples I used, Nando's, Chicken Licken, Nike, there's many examples, VW, BMW, Tesla, Patagonia. Those brands have already been accepted into culture. Drip is an example. They've already been accepted into culture. They don't have to ask permission to get into culture, not like an insurance brand does. So they've got less work to do. So when a Chicken Licken ad comes out, like people will have their, I think their guard will be down a little bit already to take that in and watch it and have an opinion around it.
Right.
Brands like insurance brands or banking brands or whatever, they've got way more work to do. They have to, their work has to work three times harder to basically get the permission from the end user just to watch it, you know. And then once they watch it, if they haven't skipped it, then they've got to go, huh, okay, that wasn't so bad for an insurance brand, or that wasn't so bad for a banking brand. Now the job of creators in that space is to really, like, you've got to, like, disarm people. You've got to get them to want to engage. And you can only do that if you get them on your side. You can only get them if you talk with them, not to them. And I think that's what we'd really try to do with the Pineapple work, was engage with people. Like, we used social lingo on billboards. We used memes. We crossed over multiple cultural references to kind of land the points. But, you know, like, one of my favorite billboards says, "You've never heard of Pineapple? Honestly, same." And, you know, like, for granted, that's the one that I'm actually the most surprised client signed off. Like that one. And when they did, I was like, you guys are rock stars, man. You guys just get it.
You really get it. I saw quite a few of these, the billboards themselves. And I think, I mean, I also have some of my own favorites among the ones that I've seen. And that one that you've mentioned also is. But also, I think there's one with insurance scratched out as well that was a favorite. And the one that says, apparently a billboard is supposed to have 8 words, and then there's a word that is combined. There are two words that are combined into one.
The recommended number of words is 8 on a billboard, and on a billboard is made into one word. I think that was the point. You know, we could have quite easily gone, like, the client came to us and they said, listen, we've got 90 sites. And we could have quite easily gone, okay, cool, let's choose the best 5 and we'll roll them out across 90 sites. So every 6th site would have the same piece of creative on it. But we felt like that wasn't the intention behind the campaign, right? We wanted to give people something rewarding. We wanted people to look out for the next Pineapple board. And when they saw another one, they've already seen 5 that they really like. So when they see the 6th one, they actively engage with it because they feel that, like, this could give them, this could make them laugh or be something different, you know, to what they've been seeing along their journey. And so we made that part of the challenge. We said to ourselves, guys, we're not going to rest until we have 90 pieces of creative. We need 90 lines that we think are good enough to go on outdoor. And, you know, anyone in advertising will tell you to get to 90, you've got to write 300. And so we did that. And we probably wrote more than 300. We probably got closer to 500 headlines. We still got them all on a file somewhere. And maybe one day we'll pull that out and share them with the world. But we wrote 500 headlines. And And it was the 500 headlines that gave us the 90 that we ended up using. And you know, still today, like clients going, oh, we've got a couple of new pieces of media. Do you have any other lines that we can use? And we had some good ones that didn't quite make the cuts and make the grade, and we've tried to push them through. But then obviously we also had to balance them out with some more brand or product focused stuff, which we also did. But I think we got the balance quite right. Like it was probably 80% humor and entertaining and 20% product stuff. But again, like that's another great recipe of creativity, right? Is this idea of just pushing. And if we had done five really good lines, if we'd taken the five best lines and we'd put them up on, we'd put each line up on 15 billboards. So they all said the same thing. I don't think it would have got the traction it did. The fact that they were different, the fact that each one says something else, the fact that each one is a new joke or a new idea to get across. I think that that's what people kind of appreciated. And that's just effort, right? Like that's just people aren't dumb. I actually want to talk about that point. People aren't dumb and they can appreciate that effort. That the more they see, the more they appreciated the effort that went into it, the more they can kind of go, oh, well, okay, I get it. Like these folks have done like a really good job. And that's actually the one thing I probably will say against the drip billboard is like, they're all the same. They've got different shoes on them, but they're all the same. And like I think that they could have got a lot more traction out of that campaign if they spent a little bit of like time thinking about the different messages that they could put out on different billboards. Even if they put like some language out there, they could have done it. They could have taken, we've got 11 languages in the country. They could have taken words of joy from all 11 languages and they could have just accompanied the shoes on every single billboard. But effort is a really, I think, big part of creativity. And one of my favorite cliches, I'm going to call it a cliche because probably a lot of people who listen to your podcast have heard this, but the biggest enemy of great creativity, the biggest enemy of great work is good work. And people often do good work. And unfortunately in this day and age, when you're talking on behalf of brands and you're talking to audiences that are receiving 2,000 messages a day, good isn't good enough. And we have to be pushing for great work. And we have to be trying to create things that are 100% original and totally new and fresh and thinking like where a consumer looks at the stuff and goes, I've never seen that before. I never thought about it like that. Or oh wow, that's amazing. Like kudos to the guys who did that. Like, and that's when that's when audiences start resonating with brands and that's when they start loving them. And like Yoko is one of those really good examples where they no longer have audiences. They don't have clients and customers. They've got a community. And they've got a community that they've been speaking. I'm sure you know Mash. Like Mash has been speaking to his audiences around Yoko and stuff for probably 4 or 5 years now. And they've got this like incredible community now of people who are just advocates of the brand. And like the brand's now starting to like sell itself, you know, and way before they even have to do any pieces of marketing. And that's the ultimate goal for brands for me. Like Nike have done it and Adidas have done it and Tesla have done it and Drip have done it now. Like they've got these communities of people who endorse, who are just mad, passionate subscribers to brands. And you can only do that if you start getting them on your side.
That's really great. And I think that's a really great point to close on because it brings us back to the fact that, you know, you almost have to ask for permission to be part of culture rather than assuming that you are. And once you are, you build that community and you build that community of customers and people who really love your brand and with whom your brand resonates. So I think for me, that's a really great point for us to end off the conversation. And yeah, it's been really insightful. I got a lot out of that. And I'm sure that when we share this, a lot more people will get a lot out of it as well.
No, thanks, Mungiz. Yeah, I think even more than asking permission, I think we've got to earn permission, and I think that's really the bottom line. And the last point I just want to land is like, please stop thinking the consumers are dumb. They're not. The consumers are really, really smart, and they appreciate when you give them the time of day. So yeah, thanks very much for having me. It's been a really great opportunity to talk about it, and yeah, really, really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Lead Creative. Did you get one insight that's worth sharing from this episode? Please share it with your network or your friends. pop me some of your ideas and innovative finds on Twitter on @Mongezi. This podcast is available on Spotify, Stitcher, Apple, Google, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also find me on mongezi.com.